For me, watches often dictate memory of place. You know, it's like, oh, a submariner on a boat in the Bahamas, a gold watch at a sexy casino in Monte Carlo, you know, a cane chair and some driving gloves with a coffee, and suddenly it's, you know, Cartier drive watch. That bit of editorial storytelling was a little bit about fantasy and a little bit about how do we make these connections to the place.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week, we're going to bring back a Hodinkee Radio fan favorite, Mr. Matt Hranek. Whether you subscribe to his magazine, the W.M. Brown magazine, or you simply follow him on Instagram, you'll know that Matt is typically a globe-trotting, crowd-enjoying kind of guy. He's never in the same place for very long. Now, obviously that's not the case these days, but that doesn't mean that Matt's not finding ways to enjoy his time while he's at his farm in upstate New York. We talk about how he's structuring his days around cooking for his family, what it's like to be producing a travel-centric lifestyle magazine during a global lockdown, and the comfort that we both find in old mechanical things. It was great catching up with an old friend I haven't gotten to see in a while, and as usual, Matt's a ton of fun and has lots of wisdom to share. Before that, though, we brought on Jack and John to talk about the avalanche of new watches that have come out this past week. The watches just keep rolling in. We cover a lot of ground this week, talking about a trio of pieces from Cartier's fine watchmaking program, a few independent releases from the likes of DeBethune and Erwerk, and a new take on a ladies' watch from Breguet that, honestly, I'm pretty into. And then to finish this week's show, we've got our own Cole Pennington talking about the watches that he's been wearing while he's been working from home and what they've taught him about his watch collection overall. It's a really great meditation on what collecting means and what it can bring to your life. I think you're going to love it. So without further ado, let's do this. Hey guys, how's it going?
Going well. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you, Jack?
Oh, nothing to complain of. You know, except things that I can't do anything about, so I'm not going to complain about them.
Classic,
good policy.
Right? Yeah. Somehow the watch world has been as busy as ever. I keep finding myself having these conversations with friends and with colleagues in other industries or related industries. And, you know, everybody's like, oh, you know, things, I'm kind of bored, like I'm getting kind of antsy, I'm ready to get back to it. And I keep finding myself being like, wait, did anything slow down? You know, like I'm working from my kitchen table. But other than that, it's we've been working at a pretty quick clip here.
I mean, I feel like it's been pedal to the metal for the last 2 weeks and we still can't take our feet off the gas. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, I mean, I think this whole pandemic just kind of happened right in the midst of, you know, what is normally the, you know, our trade show season. And it seems like the releases have just come as they normally would. We're just covering them from home.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we had Watches and Wonders Now 2 weeks ago, which I can't believe that was 2 weeks ago. Then we had a slew of sort of post Watches and Wonders releases. And then this past week, we've gotten another round of them. They just keep coming in. So I thought it'd be fun to get you guys on the show and talk through some of the releases from this week. And then we'll go through some of the hands-on stories that you guys have been cranking out as well. I think there's some really interesting watches. And in particular, there are two watches that you guys wrote about that I think make kind of an interesting pair. They're both like all-black watches from major LVMH brands. So we'll get to that, and then we've got a little bit of a preview of something from Jack that folks listening to this on Monday when it's released, we'll have to wait a day or two to see, but we'll have a little preview. So,
before we jump into it, I think had things not gone a little bananas, yesterday would have been the last day of Baselworld.
Wow.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was like either yesterday or the day before. Which I think is part of the reason why we're still seeing, you know, a fair number of releases coming out. Probably a lot of brands had communication calendars that were still a little bit, you know, tied to the show. But it is kind of crazy to think that, you know, we'd probably be irritably flying home from Switzerland right about now.
Yeah, that's exactly where we would be. All very ready for naps, yep. Which, to be honest, I could do with anyway, but.
And we heard this morning, just this morning, that Baselworld 20, 21 is scrubbed.
Yes. Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. That's a bit of news that, you know, we're going to cover more in depth next week, or maybe the week after. We're going to have an in-depth conversation with Joe about kind of how this happened and what it means. We're still kind of piecing it together. The news literally broke overnight. But yeah, it's, I think it's safe to say that this year is a transitional year. And I think next year we're going to see a very different approach to watch releases.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's get into the releases, because we've actually got a ton of watches here to talk about. So over the weekend, in the new method that they seem to be utilizing for dropping watches, a watch mysteriously appeared on the Audemars Piguet website again. And I happened to see it via a friend's Instagram. I promise I'm not just like checking AP's website every morning, although maybe I should be. But the watch in question actually comes in two variations. It's a new jumbo Royal Oak. So it's the Royal Oak extra thin, 39 millimeter, exactly what you're used to. But it comes in platinum or rose gold, including the bracelet. And then it has a smooth, glossy black dial with diamond hour markers. And it's a limited edition for Yoshida, which is one of the major retailers in Japan. And I believe it's 70 pieces in each metal. This watch is super hot.
Yeah, it's we've seen a few of these like limited editions dropping specifically for Yoshida, right? Like they seem to be getting like a lot of like the really cool new watches as exclusives.
It's an interesting thing to do. It's an interesting partnership. I mean, these watches were obviously created in partnership with and based on feedback from Yoshida. So, you know, a lot of what we're seeing is, you know, it's what they feel their clients want. These are Japan only. I think it's actually 70 for platinum and 30 for the rose gold, which seems a little bit backwards, but that's the way it is. And the dials are actually black onyx. And you know, there was some pushback in the comments because a diamond dial Royal Oak is not a lot of people's idea of a Royal Oak nowadays. I mean, you know, people think a jumbo, and the stereotype jumbo that everybody wants is, of course, you know, steel jumbo with a tapisserie dial. But there's precedent for this sort of thing. I mean, jumbos were made with non-rectangular, non-baton diamond indexes as far back as the 1970s. So it's not like this is something that AP hasn't done before. And, you know, while diamond dials on quote unquote men's watches are something that certainly not everybody's brand of vodka, not only is there historical precedent for it, I think they're both objectively handsome watches, obviously, you know, personally.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, personally, this platinum one, platinum Royal Oak, black onyx dial, diamond indexes, like, I'm hard-pressed to think of a cooler watch than that, honestly. Like, that is just so unabashedly in-your-face just goodness. But I actually like that, like, there's no diamonds on the bezel. The diamond markers are, you know, all things considered relatively small. Like, they're in proportion with the dial. They don't look like, you know, whoever's wearing this is trying to scream, like, look at me, I have diamonds.
Yep.
And I would say, I mean, you two definitely have encountered these before, but, like, for anybody listening, if you haven't seen a platinum Royal Oak on a bracelet, like, not one on a strap, but a real platinum Royal Oak with a platinum bracelet, find a way to see one. It is a thing of beauty. The way that platinum takes the Royal Oak finishing, those edges on the bracelet links, the brushing on top, it's so beautiful. And, you know, one of my favorite Royal Oaks I've ever seen is a watch. It's a Perpetual that Giulio Poppi wears, and it's his daily wearer. And it's a bimetal watch, but it has a platinum bezel. And the bezel is completely destroyed. It's super chewed up, scratched, nicked, you know, there are chunks taken out of it. It's beat up.
Yeah.
And it's one of the coolest watches I've ever seen. And I think this watch beat up a little bit could look really cool.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I would love to see specifically this platinum watch in the metal. It's one of those watches that I kind of doubt that I will be able to see in person, certainly anytime soon, just because, you know, it's like Japan exclusive and there's so few of them being made. But I'm willing to bet, just based on, like, you know, the photographs that AP took, that those diamonds are going to look really discreet, and that it's going to look hot in person.
Yeah, with a, you know, with a watch like this, I always kind of like to imagine the sort of person that I would have to be in order to wear it. And for some reason, the whole time I was writing about it, I was thinking of there's not a very well-known James Bond story in which he's talking to a guy who's, you know, a lovable rogue in a somewhat sketchy business who still, you know, kind of has a heart of gold. And he says to the guy, listen, I'm not so sure I should work with you. My dad once told me that any business that pays more than 50% profit and is not conducted during daylight hours is one that a smart man should avoid. Your business pays close to 1,000% profit and is conducted exclusively at night. And I feel like that guy would wear that platinum watch.
I love that. That's great. Awesome. Yeah, I think it's safe to say we could probably babble about how much we all like these watches till the cows come home. So I think we'll move on here. But yeah, I was you know, both not shocked and a little shocked at the negative sentiments in the comments. But I don't know. I'm purely in the fan camp here.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Let's go to something that's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum here. Jack dug up this sort of miniature capsule collection of new Cartier releases. It's a trio of three really extremely complicated watches in rose gold. So one of them is a Tourbillon Perpetual Calendar Minute Repeater. One is a Mystery Tourbillon Minute Repeater. And one is a mystery watch, a skeletonized mystery watch. This kind of harkens back to an era of Cartier watchmaking that we haven't seen for a couple of years now, something that I think was known formally as like Cartier fine watchmaking. Jack, do you want to give people some context for what this is? I know the three of us were all kind of around as this experiment happened, but it's something I think a lot of people just don't know about.
Yeah, actually, so these three watches were part of a larger group called the Cartier Fine Watchmaking Collection, which ran more or less between 2008 and 2018. And it was what Cartier brought out when they stopped doing the first Cartier Privé Collection stuff. So typically they were extremely complicated watches. A lot of them were kind of riffs on the Cartier Mystery Clocks. They were sort of wristwatch versions of the Cartier Mystery Clocks. And they were elaborately complex. Extremely expensive. Almost all of them in Raton de Cartier cases. All of them over 42 millimeters, if I remember correctly. And, you know, there were astonishing things to see. I think part of the reason that Cartier decided to dial back on the communication on them in 2018 was simply because they felt that too much attention was being put on products that maybe didn't necessarily represent the core Cartier wristwatch values that are represented better by watches like, you know, like the Tank and the Santos Dumont. You know, this year we have the Pasha. So I think it's significant repositioning for Cartier that they're foregrounding the new Privé collection over the last few years, and these are a little bit in the background. And I was sort of sad to see these fall off the radar because I just thought they were absolutely ingenious watches mechanically, and they have been out of the spotlight for long enough now that I think there's a, you know, people who have come into an interest in Cartier and fine watchmaking in the last few years aren't even necessarily aware that they exist, but they're super, super interesting watches, and you know, almost all of them represent new mechanical solutions to watchmaking problems that were never really seen before. So I was thrilled to see them on Cartier's Watchmaking Encounters platform, which was their digital platform that they launched in conjunction with Watches and Wonders 2020 this year.
I think the first time I saw these in person, actually I know the first time I saw these in person was at an event that Cartier hosted a number of years ago. It was probably 2012, 2013, at the old Cartier mansion in New York, so before the remodel. And Jack, I know you were there. John, I don't think you were there. There were like maybe three or four people. They did it in a bunch of different groups. I think you might have been in a different group. Okay. They basically showed us these watches, and you got a lot of time kind of like one-on-one with them. And they had Carol Forestia Casapi, who's the brilliant, brilliant watchmaker, who was in charge of developing these pieces and leading this effort. And she was there to kind of like walk you through them. And I remember seeing these pieces and a piece called the Astro Tourbillon, which I don't know if you guys remember.
Oh, I do remember that, yeah.
Tourbillon with like concentric perpetual calendar indicators around it.
Oh, you're thinking of the Astro Calendrier.
That's
the perpetual with the three concentric rings and the tourbillon in the middle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. Nicely done.
I mean, I should remember that. They actually did a traveling global exhibition of both vintage, Cartier watches, mystery clocks from the late 1800s going all the way up to the fine watchmaking collection. I think this was maybe 2012 also. And I actually wrote the catalog for that exhibition. So
okay.
If I
was there an Astro Tourbillon though? That name does sound like really familiar.
Oh, absolutely. There was, okay. There definitely was an Astro Tourbillon.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember
these watches blowing me away. Like they were unlike anything I'd ever seen. And I agree with you, Jack, like they didn't in a certain way feel very Cartier. Uh-huh. But they're crazy, crazy watchmaking.
Yeah.
I can't remember when I first encountered these watches, but it was probably at like SAHH some year. And I distinctly remember, you know, there were a string of years when these kinds of watches were like a focus, a big focus of the SAHH Cartier presentation. And then I guess, you know, the decision was made to focus more on more commercially viable. I wouldn't say viable, but more like mainstream commercial product. I mean, like for example, last year we saw one of the coolest watches was like a quartz, you know, Santos Dumont. I couldn't think of a more opposite kind of spin on Cartier. But yeah, these watches are like super interesting, and I mean, you really kind of like you just have to respect what they're doing.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing where you have to be kind of you have to be sort of constitutionally susceptible to being fascinated by mechanical ingenuity to, you know, get into them. But, you know, the thing about a mystery clock is you look through a mystery clock and, you know, you can see the other side of the room. The problem with a mystery watch is you put it on and you can see, you know, your wrist. You know, it's kind of like you've developed this incredibly sophisticated telescope and you know, you train it on the surface of Mars for the first time and you see the Martian equivalent of a McDonald's. You know, it's like the instrument is more interesting than the final view. But I love these things. I mean, you know, I love the ID1, the ID2 concept watches. And, you know, I was very pleasantly surprised to see these on the Cartier watch encounters digital platform. It just put a smile on my face.
Yeah, I'm hoping we see a little bit more of this. You know, I'm you know, vocally a huge supporter of the Santos Dumont. Even I really like the Drive Ultra Flats that they did a couple years ago. I know some people have mixed feelings about those, but I really like them. But I think this brings another like fun side to Cartier, and it shows that like yes, they can make design icons, but they can also flex when they need to on the watchmaking side.
For sure.
And you know, you've got to imagine that some of the R&D that goes into producing stuff like this makes its way into the, you know, lower end, more accessible in-house movements that show up in these other pieces. So yeah. I think it's probably a good thing for Cartier all around.
I agree.
Let's go to a couple other like unusual pieces. You know, we saw some funky stuff get released, maybe not in this vein, but we had new introductions from both DeBethune and Erwerk this week. You know, Jack, this will be the third story in a row of yours we're gonna touch on, but
I have nothing else to do.
I know, man, you're cranking this stuff out, but tell us about the DeBethune DB28 XP, which is a 10-year anniversary piece for the DB28.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I wouldn't say that I have mixed feelings about DeBethune, because I don't. I actually really, really love their watches. I love their watchmaking. There are some of their pieces that I find, you know, absolutely irresistible. Pretty much anything with that 3D moon phase display that they have is astonishing. So what we have here in the DB28 XP, so the DB28's been around for 10 years, and this is a 10th year anniversary extra flat celebration of DB28, and it looks in photographs and in person it's just an extraordinary watch. It's very, very thin. It has all of the things that you sort of associate with DeBethune. You've got that you know, kind of Star Trek insignia, you know, central plate with micro light polishing, and the escapement and the balancer on display. And my first recollection of DeBethune is, you know, sort of a dyed in the wool mechanics nerd, was there was a while there, in the mid 2000s, where it seemed like they were coming out with a new patent and a dramatically different new kind of combination of balance spring and escapement every 5 minutes. I mean, they have a lot of, you know, patents to their credit, and it was just this sort of exuberant exploration of all of the different possibilities that you could explore if you were interested in refining the most basic organ of the watch, which is the oscillating system. And you know, to this day, I can think of maybe two or three other brands that were that aggressively investigative about that aspect of the watch, and that combined with their really, really, I think, unique design language, made DeBethune, I mean, really a critic's darling, and I think a lot of enthusiasts gravitated to them as well, simply because they weren't just coldly technical watches. They were watches that somehow managed to take what's exciting about technical watchmaking and translate that into a design language and an aesthetic vision that you know, really wasn't like anything anybody else had. And I think that the DB28 XP, it's just a delicious watch.
And my God, those articulated lugs, the way they kind of like flex on your wrist. If you've, you know, have you guys ever like tried these on, this watch?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is just like, it is one of the coolest watches to put on your wrist. And I typically don't gravitate toward, more out there kind of designs. But there's something about Debatoon that, I mean, kind of like from the first moment I ever saw one of these watches or even a picture of it, I kind of fell in love.
Yeah, there are certain aspects of machinery that it's just kind of, it's really just fun to see them in motion, you know, and putting on one of these watches and feeling the lugs kind of, you know, flex around your wrist as you, you know, as you put it on, it's like sitting in a Gullwing Mercedes and closing the door, you know, you're just like,
That is an incredibly apt comparison. Yes.
You know, you're like, that's cool.
I find myself every time I put a Debatoon on my wrist trying to like rationalize it to myself. It's one of those watches I see it and I like it so much, and then I put it on my wrist and I try to talk myself into it. Like maybe I could be the kind of person who could wear one of these. Like maybe I wouldn't look a little bit insane walking around with like a 45 millimeter bright polished titanium articulated lug, like blued moon phase, whatever, on my wrist. Like maybe I could pull this off, No, I've never quite gotten all the way there, but I think it says something about like how cool and enticing they are as little like art objects and little mechanical works, that I find myself like wanting to change myself to make it work.
Oh yeah, I mean it's definitely, I don't think it's a watch that I could get away with wearing on a daily basis. You know, either I'm you know too old and frazzled and grumpy, but I still like it an awful lot. And you know, this science fiction kind of vibe that it has, it's not overstated, but it's definitely there. You know, for all you Star Wars fans out there, I feel like you know, if you saw an advertisement for this watch in the Star Wars universe, at the bottom it would say, you know, in discreet you know sans serif caps, as worn by the Royal Court of Naboo.
You know, it's funny. I was reading your story this morning, Jack, and I saw you linked out to something that James wrote about a different take on this watch, like a different, like a dive watch variation, mm-hmm. That came out a bit earlier. And I think he closed by, you know, saying something about how a watch like this appeals to him in a similar way that like a supercar appeals to the 5-year-old inside him. And I think that was also very apt. That's kind of how I view this watch, I would say.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's jump over to the other independent that we had launched something this week, which is another brand that I constantly find myself trying to talk myself into, which is Erwerk. And this introduction actually came in the shop journal from our friends over in the Hodinkee shop. But I wanted to talk about it anyway. This is the Erwerk UR100 in yellow gold. Yellow gold Erwerk. Like, that's all I have to say. Like, yellow gold Erwerk. How awesome is that?
Yeah, I happen to love this particular complication. You know, it's the one that shows basically how many miles I forget if they use miles or kilometers. I think it's kilometers, actually. The Earth rotates at the equator over 20 yeah. minute, I think over 20 minute intervals. And it's based on, as a complication, it's actually based on a clock that was made in the late 1800s, which was purchased by the father of one of Debatoon's founders. And that clock is in their office in Geneva. And the first time I visited their office, I was taking pictures of some of the clocks that were there. And when I came to that one, you know, I consider myself reasonably good at figuring horological stuff out after all these years. But I looked at it and I was like, what the hell is this thing measuring? and Felix Baumgartner was there and he sort of explained the whole thing to me. And I had as a passing thought, wow, wouldn't that make a cool wristwatch, and thought no more about it. And then a few years later, lo and behold, there it was as a wristwatch. And I kind of love this one in gold, you know. I mean, the shop team did a great job in terms of, you know, visually styling it. There is something about the yellow gold that makes you sort of think of solar cycles and, you know, connects you to the motion of the sun across the sky and the motion of the earth around the sun. And I love it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Jack. Like, to me, this works on like a poetic level, and it also just aesthetically, like, there's a lot of yellow gold surface area here, and the way they finished it with the like circular brushing on top, it's it's unlike anything else. Like, again, I find myself looking at this watch and saying, like, how can I be the sort of person who can get away with wearing this? Because I just feel like my life would be so much cooler with this watch a part of it, you know?
You should give yourself a chance, man.
Yeah, let's see. When we get back to the office, maybe I'll go go upstairs and give it a little try. All right, the last watch introduction I want to talk about this week is the complete opposite end of the spectrum, but I think we have to mention it, is Breguet released a Queen of Naples with a Grand Fou enamel dial. It's the first time they've done that, which is strange. It feels like a thing that should have always existed, but there we have it. But it's really nice. I mean, the Queen of Naples is a polarizing design. Some people love it, some people hate it. I think it's interesting. I'm not sure quite which side of the line I ultimately fall on, but this feels like kind of like the right execution to me. I don't know. How do you guys feel about it?
I think the dial is quite nice, and I'm surprised that they have not done this type of enamel dial on a Queen of Naples. It seems the numerals. I'm just looking at the hero image in the article right now, and it's striking.
Yeah, I think they did a wonderful job with the dial on this one. You know, you have, especially on the ones numerals, and we talk about this in the story, you have that wonderful elongated, super, super thin stroke, and the curvature is so beautifully controlled. I mean, just as a piece of enamel dial work. I mean, you expect that from Breguet, you expect top level execution for dial work, but still, I think it's worth calling out when you see it. And I have always been a big fan of the Queen of Naples watches. You know, I mean, the history has been repeated, you know, quite a few times, but, Carolyn Marat, who was Queen of Naples for not that long a period of time. I think it was something like 1813 to 1818. Is that possible? Just a few years?
I love that you even maybe know that. Like, I'm not going to fact check you here, but I love that you're even close.
I think that she was related to Napoleon, right? Like, she was like a sister or something.
She was a sister, and she was she was the Queen Regent of Naples for a fairly short period of time, but a huge Breguet enthusiast, and ordered something like I think 30 plus watches and clocks, a number of which she gave as gifts. So for a short period of time, you know, she was probably plowing more money into Breguet's workshops in Paris than just about anybody else, and he designed for her I think it was a quarter repeater with a cylinder escapement and a thermometer, and it had this basic shape. And the watch, this is one of the great lost watches of watchmaking. Nobody knows where it is, although I've heard rumors, which I have not tried to follow up, I have to admit, about where it might be today. But so all of the modern Queen of Naples watches are based on that same basic template. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the wrist, I think they look extremely elegant. The, you know, case shape is, you know, quite unusual. And if you're going to wear, you know, a watch kind of as much as a, you know, sort of aesthetic ornament as you are, you know, a timepiece, which, let's face it, on a certain level, that's what a lot of us do. I think the Queen of Naples watches are a fantastic way to go. There's something about that egg-shaped case that, you know, just radiates elegance. And as a sort of evening watch, I mean, you know, we're not going to many Met Galas these days. Actually, I didn't go to many Met Galas at all even before these days. but if you're going to go, this would be a great watch to wear.
You know what for me is one of the unsung triumphs of this watch that I absolutely love is the small ring of diamonds on the inside of the bezel. Like, it's on, like, the rehaut. Like, where the crystal meets the case. They're tiny diamonds. They're spaced, you know, relatively far apart. Like, they're not butting up against one another. But I would love to see in person how that affects how the dial looks. I would imagine it actually, like, brightens up the dial. There may be a sort of functional aspect to this. Because otherwise, this egg-shaped case, it has steep sides on the inside, and it might actually create shadows on that enamel. And I wonder if the diamonds are serving some sort of functional purpose here. Even if they're not, it's cool, and it's something I don't think I've ever seen before executed in quite this way. And it's like, you know, there was no reason they had to do this, but I'm there for it.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny you should mention it, Stephen. It's not a detail that I've seen on. I mean, I'm sure that somebody else has done it at some point, but it probably happens more in conjunction with watches that are also pave diamonds on the dial as well. And it's just a great little touch.
Yeah. All right. I want to make sure we get to the two other things I wanted to talk about today, and we're already running a little bit long here. But you know, the first thing here is you each wrote a hands-on story this week. With an all-black watch that's a variation on something we already know. And I wanted to talk about that quickly. So Jack, you wrote a hands-on story with the Bulgari Octofinissimo Automatic in the black sandblast polished ceramic execution. And John, you did a hands-on with the Zenith Chronomaster Revival Shadow. So these are two watches that are sort of like familiar. They're pretty iconic. They use, you know, movements that we've come to know, but these are all black executions. In the case of the Zenith, it's a sort of matte black on a strap. And in the case of the Bulgari, it's a highly polished black with a bracelet. You know, maybe Jack, let's start with you. How do you think this execution of the Octofinissimo sort of like changes the game, as it were? Like, what does this bring to the party that's new and different?
Well, I don't know, Stephen. You know, I mean, I think from the comments that people are getting a little tired of hearing me say how much I like the Bulgari Octofinissimo watches, but I like the Bulgari Octofinissimo watches.
People are going to have to get used to it, man. I think most of us are fans of these watches.
I don't see that changing, so.
Yeah, sorry. All of you guys who are tired of it, you're going to have to find something else. That's not changing.
Or, you know, like, you know, keep at me. I can take it. But, I mean, I'm joking a little bit because the designs in general actually seem to be quite popular. It's a big commercial success for Bulgari. And, you know, I've said this a bunch of times on the site, but I'll say it again. These have watches, you know, the Bulgari Octofinissimo watches have not been around for all that long. This is actually a relatively new collection. You know, if you look at it in watchmaking years, which I think are kind of the opposite of dog years. It really feels like a classic design that has long been a part of the modern watchmaking landscape, in spite of the fact that it's new. So this is the second more polished version of an existing Octofinissimo automatic that we've seen this year. There was the steel one, which came out earlier, and then this one. And both of those in their original versions had the sort of matte sandblasted finish, which gave the watches a very cool kind of, you know, postmodern, you know, walking through the dark, shadowy streets of a post-apocalyptic metropolis, you know, in a world that is both brave and new and slightly terrifying. You know, that was kind of the vibe I always got from them. Am I reading too much into them?
I wasn't going to say anything, Jack, but we'll let you go.
Okay. And these are actually, it's funny, these are more, you know, these two, this black sandblast polished ceramic one and the steel one, this is a more traditional way to approach watch finishing, in fact. And yet in a funny sort of way, it takes these, the more conventional finish actually makes these watches look even more unconventional, at least to me. You know, it's a more, high polish is, you know, just in general, I mean, something shiny is more conventionally associated with luxury. But in this case, I think it really emphasizes the facets in the case and the sophistication of the case design. And especially for what Bulgari is asking for these pieces in terms of what's available, you know, in terms of competition, I think you just get so much in terms of, you know, smart, idiosyncratic design. Ceramic ultra thin watches can be a little tricky because it's a very light material. And if there's a fault that ultra thin watches can have kinesthetically when they're worn, it's they can feel almost a little bit too light for their own good. So, that's always a risk when you do ultra thin watchmaking with a ceramic, but I think that's actually counterbalanced a little bit in this case. The polishing obviously doesn't add any physical weight, but it adds some visual, visual mass, but visual weight, so to speak, I guess, to the watch that makes it feel a little bit more, actually a little bit more comfortable to wear on the wrist and in a way more versatile.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think I agree. I mean, I tend to be a bigger fan of the sort of matte finishes on these. And I think ultimately if I was going to buy an Octofinissimo, it would not be a polished version. But I agree with you that it really like, handling this watch, I got to see it when it was in the office for you to take a look at before we were all working remotely. And yeah, it's just like, it really, you see things about the Octofinissimo design that I don't think you would notice otherwise.
Yeah, I agree. It's, this is the, there have been other polished versions though, haven't there? Like, but not in ceramic?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I'm in your camp, Stephen. That it's I tend to gravitate more toward the matte finishes, but I think you see a bit more detail in the in these polished finishes, and yeah. So I mean, I guess to each his own for that. But if I'm buying one, I'm probably going to go for the matte titanium.
So while we're talking about matte finishes, I mean, that's a nice way to transition, John, over to the watch you wrote about, which is the Chronomaster Revival Shadow. Can you tell us a little bit about this watch and your sort of experience with it?
Yeah, no. So this is it's a super cool watch. It comes kind of from what I think is an interesting premise, which is it's based on a prototype from the early 1970s that Zenith made. In that, a number of people within the company. Within the company Zenith were remembered, but then they discovered an example of it at the factory right as they were kind of like ramping up to do all of the new and exciting activities around the anniversary of the El Primero. And they decided that, you know, this was a watch that was kind of from a similar era and it would be fun to do a tribute to it as well. And so, but as a watch that had never been made, there was no name, there was no reference number. And, people's memory of it didn't really exist out in the world, although the Hodinkee shop did some time ago sell an example of this prototype. So I linked to it in my story if you want to go take a look at it. They had some latitude to express, to pay an homage to it in a way that they wanted to. And so what they did was they took a fairly similar case, which is that of the A384 revival, which is itself, a tribute to the El Primero, with a much more kind of a, although it came out in 1969, a much more forward-looking into the 70s aesthetic, with its angular tonneau shaped case. And so now, it's an all black microblasted titanium case in the shape of this A384. I think it's quite visually striking. I love the way the dial, which is a much darker shade of black, if I can say that, contrasts with the matte finish of the case. And I don't typically go for all black watches, and I think I mentioned this in the article. But when they can be made quite legible, I think legibility can be an issue with some of them out there, then I will consider them. And that's definitely the case with this watch. As I look at a picture of it in the article right now, it really, this is an all black watch that I could see myself going for, to be honest. It's quite nice.
You know, one of my favorite things about this watch, no date at 4:30.
Yep. Yeah. And that's
the 4:30 date window is like one of my, I'm okay with date windows. I'm wearing a watch with a date window on it right now. But that date window is at 3 o'clock. It's not at 4:30. 4:30 drives me nuts. And this watch just shows, is like, you put it side by side with the A384 revival from last year. And it's just like, God, the watch is so much better without that date window. The dial's so clean, it's so beautiful. You really get the emphasis of those two larger sub registers. I think this design's really beautiful. Jack, do you have any thoughts on this watch?
Not a whole lot other than that, I really like it. I had an opportunity to see the prototype in the shop before it was sold. And I think that this one is, I think it's a really, really interesting watch. Really, really beautiful design. I'm not normally a fan of all black watches, but there's something about the proportions on this one and the kind of, the way that they've really restricted the palette very purely to, to sort of black, white, and grayscale, and let the material speak for itself without trying to play with light too much. It's got a very stripped down utilitarian, feel to it. It almost reminds me of a really high end sports car that's just whose owner has painted it primer black and just left it that way. Yeah. And there's something actually really cool about that. And this has the same functional feel to me. And all black watches to me don't often feel, kind of stripped down and functional, but I think this one has that vibe in spades.
Steven, you pointed out that there's no date window, and that's also the case with the prototype that inspired it. One kind of cool factoid about that prototype was that it used a movement that had that was one of the bridges was signed Movado. And that's something that I knew because I'd written a little bit about Zenith in the past, that they were along with Mondia, co-owned as part of a smaller group going back in the late 60s, early 70s. But I had never seen a Movado signed movement in a Zenith watch, and I don't know if it's ever happened before. Zenith El Primeros in Movados are not terribly uncommon, and they actually can be had for a pretty good value. I've never seen it going the other way.
All right, so the last question I'll ask you guys on this: matte black or gloss black? If you have to choose at the end of the day, polished or matte, Jack?
Oh gosh, depends on the watch. I mean, we have two watches here that, you know, I love the Bulgarian polished and I love the Zenith in matte. And I think that the Zenith polished would, I think it wouldn't work.
Yeah. I'm going to go with the Zenith matte, I think.
I'm going to go with matte black across the board. I'm gonna, so we got three editors, three opinions. I think that sounds about right to me. All right. The last thing I want to talk about today before I let you guys go, go back to your actual jobs other than gabbing with me on mic. Jack, you've got a story that's going to come out, you know, next week. We're recording this at the end of the previous week. That's an interview you did with Piaget CEO Chabi Nouri. And I was wondering if you could give us just a quick preview of that chat, kind of maybe what your highlight of the conversation was and the most interesting thing you learned from her to get people primed and ready for this interview.
Well, I think to me, you know, I don't want to give anything away, obviously, but I think the thing that is worth thinking about when you think about Piaget, and she addresses this in the interview, is so here's a company which, you know, historically, you know, they've got their own movement manufacturer up in La Côte-de-Fay. They were associated historically with beautiful watchmaking, ultra-thin watchmaking, very, very, you know, very mechanically refined watches. And they have become at least as strongly positioned in many people's minds, I think in recent years especially, as a maker of high jewelry watches and of jewelry per se. So this year we got, a little while ago we got the Piaget Altiplano Ultimate Concept Watch. And this was presented as a concept watch. There were four of them made. It's a watch that's only two millimeters thick overall, which is thinner than most movements. And, you know, I saw this thing, and, you know, I think you did too, and I think we all had the same reaction when we saw it. Well, that's really cool, but they're never going to be able to make it. They're never going to make this as a they're never going to make this as a production piece. They didn't want us to so much as look at it cross-eyed for fear it would shatter into a million tiny pieces when they first showed it to us. And, you know, it took 45 minutes of intense negotiation at the highest levels for me to get a wrist shot out of it the first year that it was shown. So this year we have this watch, and it is being presented as a production piece with all sorts of customization options. I think if you put all the possible permutations together, you've got over 100,000 different possibilities. And while the price is on request, and I'm sure you know, eye-watering, nonetheless, it remains an actual production watch. So one of the things that Ms. Nouri talks about, you know, in her position as CEO with a more sort of, you know, with definitely a hawk's eye perspective on the destiny of the company, how do you steer a company which has historically had two very strong but not necessarily always connected identities? How do you steer it into the future while honoring both halves of its heritage? I mean, the Ultimate Concept Altiplano, this is one of the most technically sophisticated watches in terms of design and material science that is out there today. So for sure, this is a statement loud and clear. Piaget is not just a jewelry company. You can come here for, you know, wonderful stones and great setting, and you can get them, but you can also get some of the most mechanically forward-looking watches on the planet. And from a communications and leadership standpoint, and this was my question to her, you know, sort of what do you do? And she gives some great answers, and I look forward to people, you know, checking in and seeing what she has to say.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. You know, I've chatted with her once or twice, but not quite in this way. So I'm looking forward to the story as much as everybody who's listening. Thanks for sitting down and chatting with me, guys. I know this was a long segment, and we had a lot to talk about. But yeah, I'm excited to see. Hopefully, this time next week, we've got another pile of new watches to talk about.
Cool. Sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah, we sure will. Thank you very much, Stephen. Thanks for having us on.
Up next, we've got my conversation with Matt Horanek. Hey, man, good to see you.
Hey, Steven, how you doing?
Good. This is our first, I think, virtual hangout in a long time.
Yeah, am I in your bedroom?
Yeah, I'm in a studio apartment. So if anyone's in my apartment, they're in my bedroom. But yeah, it's we've got the couch and we've got the bed. It's a full service room.
I feel a little awkward being in your bedroom, but that's okay.
Yeah, it's all right. You're a friend. You're allowed. And you're coming to us from your farm upstate, right?
Yeah, I'm sort of. It's pretty magical. I mean, it's freezing up here. Like it feels like. It still feels like late winter up here.
Ugh, jeez. And we're recording this in May. Like people should know this is not like an old episode that we've banked. It's not the middle of winter right now.
Yeah, I'm wearing a wool fisherman knit turtleneck and wool socks and a thermal. Like it is cold up here, but it's magical. You know, it's great. So we're good.
And so that's where you've been spending the bulk of your time during the quarantine?
I think we've been up here with a little break about 50 days now.
Okay.
We came back to Brooklyn to kind of like, we kind of left in haste and then realized we needed some stuff because I'm still building, Yolanda and I are both building the summer issues of the magazine. So she was desperate to get back and pick through the office and get some stuff. And same with me. And
yeah,
grab an extra pair of pants because I was sick of wearing the same 501s every single day. and now we're back. And I think we're going to hunker down here until we see what changes in New York around mid-May or so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it must be strange. Even though you're used to traveling a lot, I think you're probably used to doing what I do, which is like, it's a lot of coming and going. So it must be weird, A, to be in one place this long, and B, not to be in New York City for this long.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, we had a very aggressive travel schedule for end of May, June. And of course, that isn't going to happen. So we're very desperate to figure out, like, when can we get to Europe? You know, I have this house in the southwest of France. We had work in Italy to deal with. So that is the most anxious making thing in terms of the travel end of things. You know, I've been saying, like, I built this house. We bought this property some 20 years ago to kind of celebrate isolation, like to be away from New York. And this, for me, is a real luxury to be up here this much time. We've never spent this much time ever here.
It's funny. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about kind of like what I've learned about my own travel habits from this. You know, I'm in New York City in my apartment, haven't left. And last year, from August 1 to the end of the year, I was out of New York more than half the time. Right. And I now haven't been on an airplane in 2020 at all. And yeah, it's a huge, huge change. But there's something nice about that stability and about being in one place and kind of experiencing the same people and the same things and getting into a routine. There's something sort of tranquil and centering about it that I think maybe provides me a little bit of balance in contrast to last year.
Since we talk about routine, and I've definitely fell into a routine up here, I thought I would make a Negroni for you. You could have a
virtual. I love that.
Okay, so
I love that.
I have some vintage Punta Mes. This, you know, this has become a tradition, a Houdinki tradition of me making
Negroni. Okay.
I have some 1960s vintage Campari. I keep all the good stuff up here. Some gin straight out of the freezer, little monkey, and some really nice ice. Okay, so there's the ice.
There we go.
We're just going to eyeball it. A little glug glug of gin. The vermouth.
There we go.
And some Campari. I like a little heavier hand on the Campari. And
I'm with you.
The garnish.
Boop. Perfect.
And there we go. Salute.
Cheers, sir. I'm still drinking a cup of tea over here, but you know, same spirit.
You gave me the excuse to make a 2 o'clock Negroni.
That's what we're here for. Again, it's quarantine. There are no rules here, right? It's 5 o'clock always, all the time.
You know, I have to say, like, we don't do a lot of heavy afternoon drinking, but like come 5-6 o'clock, we're like out of the gate. You know, it's like,
yeah,
what's for dinner?
I had majorly cut down on drinking at home, mostly reserving it for a celebratory thing and out in the world. And with all the travel, it was just easier. And I've really found the joy in the after work cocktail at home. There's something nice about the pause, the break in the day. And I think that for me is one of the biggest things is finding ways to break up the day. And, you know, we're as busy as ever actually over at Houdinki, and I'm sure you're the same. And it's finding that way to say, like, okay, the laptop's closed. It's not work time anymore. I've got a drink in my hand. I'm going to start cooking dinner. And it's a nice way to kind of like detox from all the work and prevent, you know, my apartment from feeling like an office 24 hours a day.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've only ever been a freelancer, right? I've never really had a job. Like, I've never had to show up at an office. So I early on put some parameters on that kind of thing. Like, sure, I get up, I start my work if I'm not if I wasn't going to the studio or if I wasn't on location. And then, but I made a conscious effort early on to be like, okay, this is when I stop working. And then this does not become an office anymore.
Yeah.
This becomes a house. This becomes a place where you live. And sure, do you get under stress and deadlines and you're working beyond that? Fine. But I am not productive past that. So I've just known, like, okay, we're going to shut down now and start fresh. I'm going to walk away. And that has been how I've navigated my entire kind of adult professional life. So I think we try to do the same here. And, you know, Yolanda will just can keep working if there was a strong Wi-Fi signal for 24 hours. So, but I definitely established some ground rules of like, okay, I'm not, it's over. Like, let's have a drink. Let's make a nice dinner. Let's be together and just focus on that.
Yeah. I think it's one of the funny things is I think when people think of you, you know, people at large, you may or may not actually know you, people who may just, you know, follow you on Instagram and read the magazine, think of you as, you know, it's where in the world is Matt Horanek today. But one of the things I always think of when I think of you is being at home. Like, I think you have this great balance of like, sure, if you're in Italy, you know, you're driving a beautiful car, you end up at a great hotel, you're by the pool, it's awesome. But you can also have those kind of like aspirational at-home experiences of, you know, buying a great piece of meat from your local butcher and grilling it outside with your family and mixing cocktails and having friends over. And, you know, we can't do the having friends over part right now, but I think people who, again, are following you on Instagram are probably getting some insight into to that side of Matt Horanek and that side of the sort of W.M. Brown lifestyle.
Well, I think up here more than ever, like, I really love this house. We bought this, we built this house, almost 17, 18 years ago. And it was a prefabricated house that was made by an architect who's now a dear friend of mine in Austria, in a factory, put on four containers, and then brought up here and assembled by three other Austrians. It was insane that we even thought that we could do that. But we did it, and the whole house is kind of designed around this central kitchen and this open floor plan. And I feel, I just love being here. It's so inspiring to be here. Even, you know, when I'm in New York, I'm inspired by the street and the social activity and meeting people in bars and restaurants and running into you on the street or seeing Ben, you know, like, that to me is what I loved about New York and love about New York. That doesn't give me that now. So I was just sort of sad when I was there. I was like, I got to get out of here. I have to go back to where we established this idea of what it would be like to be away from it all and everyone. Like, I don't have neighbors for miles, you know, even though they kind of drive up on their gaiters and we all have a beer within 10 feet of each other. You know, it's like, but I really appreciate this time here, and it's been incredibly inspiring for me. So I'm making, you know, lemonade out of lemons for sure. And, you know, I'm a sensitive homebody. Like, I do like the little minor luxuries that are here, even if that's like great kitchen equipment or really good sheets. Like, we're in the country, but, you know, there is touches of those things that I've appropriated and a taste I acquired from traveling around the world.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like one of the main things you're finding, you know, entertainment or solace or whatever you want to call it in is food and is cooking. I know I've enjoyed following along your cooking adventures, and, you know, I've always been somebody who likes to cook, and it's something I've been doing a lot of as well. And I wonder why for you is that kind of a source of daily pleasure?
Well, I would say cooking. The kitchen has always been a therapeutic place and a kind of therapy for me. I grew up with a big Italian family. I was surrounded by women in a kitchen all the time, my entire life. And then my aunt had a little diner restaurant. My uncle had a bar, restaurant, pizza place. And I was just constantly around. So for me, like, watching and growing up with those amazing people, mostly women, was to find out how that place was, the kitchen was about social activity and about inspiration and about love and about nurture and feeding. And it was never a labor. It was never like, oh, we have to make dinner. It was like, we're going to make dinner. It was like that. So I grew up with that. And I find that just through osmosis, I kind of learned all that. It's sort of like in my DNA. So I find that I'm in my most exciting, comfortable place, like sort of in the kitchen or prepping something. And that could be opening a tin of sardines and putting it on toast. It doesn't have to be elaborate. And, you know, I see that happening with Clara, and, you know, Yolanda's like the best audience for all this stuff. And for me, I get up in the morning, I make a pot of coffee or turn the coffee pot on and start planning lunch. And then as soon as lunch is finished, we're like, okay, what's for dinner? And we're so lucky, and we're so lucky up here because we have, you know, this is the cornucopia of, you know, the best farmers and dairy and meat in like New York State. Like I'm just surrounded by it. So like in my local supermarket, it's just, you know, it's just easier up here. Like there's no stress under those things that could be stressful for day to day. So, you know, you go to my local supermarket here and my local wine shop, it's just incredible stuff. So, and then, you know, I have been known to do a little bird hunting and things like that. So like I have a freezer full of game as well, which is, it really is a luxury for me, you know?
Yeah. I guess what are maybe like two or three dishes that you think people listening should try while they're in quarantine? Like stuff that maybe is a little more work than you'd want to put in if you had to like, you know, commute to and from the office. Nothing too crazy, but like stuff that is fun, is maybe a new experience, is something you can share with whoever your loved ones are that you're quarantining with.
Okay, here's one foolproof. You know, I love eggs. And if you eat eggs, buy the best eggs you could possibly get. Go through your fridge. And anything that you find that's left over in the fridge, like some roasted cauliflower or some spinach or like some wilting green or an old onion, you chop it all up. You put it in a big cast iron pan with good olive oil. And you just turn everything into frittatas that are kind of going bad. And you put a little garlic and onion and like a little smoked paprika, and all of a sudden all that stuff that normally, I'm telling you, in Brooklyn would have gone right in the compost bin suddenly becomes a meal where you're like, holy cow, why is that so good? You know? Yeah. And I think it's a beautiful, elegant thing when you serve it in a pan. It doesn't have to come out in perfect slices. You could spoon it out. And I know you have a glass of really nice, crisp white wine for lunch with that. And it's like, oh, I'm in Spain, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's an easy go-to. I also think opening up, if you like fish and tinned fish like I do, opening up a tin of tuna or a tin of anchovy with a little caper in a pan with some boiled spaghetti is the most heavenly thing ever. And you pair that with some toasted breadcrumb or a good Parmesan, and like, it's just other level. Like I find that as I get older, the simpler applications of things are the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think that's something that is interesting about your taste in general, is it's always elevated, but it's always like an elevated version of a thing that feels approachable. Like I never see something that you're into and I'm like, okay, I need to go do 20 hours of research to have any idea what's going on here. It's always, I can always get a foothold and then I realize there's more to it. And like, it kind of pulls you in instead of pushing you away.
Well, first of all, I'm too lazy to do all that prep work. Like I'm inherently lazy about all that stuff. So, I'm a lousy reader too. I, you know, but these cookbooks that I've been diving into, And I've been collecting cookbooks for 20 years, and they're all stored up here. So we were just digging mm-hmm. into Jacques Pepin and Tom Colicchio, or all this Israeli cooking of these, you know, that I never really had time to really look at and say, oh, guess what? It's not as complicated as you think, you know. And P.S., yeah. all these books are based on kind of peasant food. So mm-hmm. the reward of that result from, you know, making braises with cheap cuts of meat and turns into incredible ragouts, or, you know, these are the secrets of great, great chefs. Not that I'm a great chef, but like, for example, the Babo cookbook that I haven't opened up in years has the most amazing recipes that are just like all cheap ingredients just elevated the best way.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think we could probably sit and chat about food for the rest of our chat, but I'm going to push things. I want to make sure we get to talk about WM Brown magazine.
Okay, great.
Because I know you mentioned that the summer issue is consuming a lot of your time right now. And I want to get to that, but before we do, I want to talk about a story or a little I guess sort of like photo essay in the last issue or the current issue. Which is about watches and places. Yeah. And it's a way to approach watches that I found really interesting. So for people who haven't seen the magazine, which if you haven't, we'll link it up in the show notes. You should go order a copy like right now. But there's a photo essay right at the front of the book that is watches shot in sort of meaningful places. And I think there's something that really resonated about that, with me and I think I know a lot of other collectors who maybe feel the same way. I've had conversations sort of around this idea before, but the idea that watches can be tied to a place and can connect you to a place or an experience that lasts beyond when you leave, which is something that as we're all spending time kind of in the same four walls most of the time, maybe speaks to me a little bit more than usual. But I wonder, you know, I'll stop babbling, but I wonder if you can maybe speak to where that idea came from for you.
So when I was at Condé Nast Traveler, I was covering the watch market. And one of my biggest frustrations was they gave me 2 watch pages a year. That's it. Mm. And I was fresh and new to this kind of editorial watch world. Of course, like I fell in love with every single brand, like every brand that I went to go see at SIHH or Basel. Like I'm a sucker. Like I love watches. I fell in love with them all. But I was not allowed to cover single brands specifically, or I had to figure out how to package groups. And I just like, this is the most ridiculous thing ever. And I don't want to do that anymore. And as a lot of watch brands started, you know, they came late to the game for the record, I think, exploring the digital end of things, then suddenly they were like, yeah, we'll take a digital page instead of an editorial print page. I was like, this is it. This is a way I could celebrate one watch brand, unadulterated, single, big, full image. But how would we tie it into travel? And for me, watches often kind of dictate memory of place. You know, it's like, oh, a Submariner on a boat in the Bahamas, a gold watch at a sexy casino in Monte Carlo. You know, that was just the fantasy. Yeah. So I said, why don't we tie watches with travel that way? And that's how that started. So when I left Condé Nast and was moving on to doing William Brown, that was one way I wanted to cover watches. I knew I could never be like you guys. I just don't have the bandwidth, the knowledge, and the expertise to dive deep. But I knew that I was responding to watches and brands on an aesthetic level, and I knew personally that I could make those space connections. So that's why it was like, you know, a Panerai on a boat off the coast of, you know, Tuscany, or, you know, and even if I never, a lot of the watches I actually bring on location and do that. But sometimes we just create the fantasy of place. And that could be as simple as like a cane chair and some driving gloves with a coffee. And then suddenly it's, you know, Cartier drive watch, you know?
Right.
So, you know, that bit of editorial storytelling was a little bit about fantasy and a little bit about how do we make these connections to place.
Yeah. I wonder, are there any watches for you in your own collection that have a sort of place memory attached to them, where when you're wearing the watch up at your farm, you look down at it and you're sort of like transported somewhere?
Yeah, for sure. And the interesting thing is, when we were making this kind of ridiculously fast exit, I got in the car and Yolanda, who is, I mean, she's not nutty for watches. She likes them, but she's not, she said, "I brought all my watches. Did you bring all your watches?" And I was like, "No, they're all in the safe." And I like ran back in the house and I grabbed them all.
Yeah.
And there was a certain level of comfort with that. And when I got up here, I was just sort of like, oh, I haven't worn this one in a while. I haven't worn this one in a while. And it's interesting because I have always bought watches from a very passionate point of view. My theory on buying watches was, and this came actually from Yolanda, was, are you in love with it? If you could justify your love for it, then of course you should buy it. And I thought that was I think it's a very good way. I buy art that way, photography that way. You know, I try to buy anything I purchase that's a big commitment. I'm like, am I really in love? Am I in love with it? So all the watches that I grabbed and opened up in a very early Houdinki watch roll that you gave me in brown leather, Velcro strap.
It's the OG stuff.
Yeah. When I pull out the watches, I'm like, holy cow. Like, for example, this is a Heuer Pasadena that I bought in Los Angeles, some kind of junky little jewelry shop years and years ago. And I remember I was on a job and I felt like a little flush with cash. And I was like, hey, let's go check out this watch shop. And a friend of my dad's owned this watch and wore this watch all through my memory of him growing up when I was in high school. And he was so cool. He had like custom made Italian jackets and drove a gold Lancia mid engine. And he was just the cool guy. So that watch represented that guy. And I saw it in the case and I was like, I need to own that watch. And I bought it for I thought it was just so much money at the time. It was like $800, you know, and I was just like, here's my big purchase. And I don't wear it often for whatever reason. I don't know, but I have been wearing it like crazy here. And it's been nice to make those connections to that place in my life and why I bought it and who influenced me in terms of the aesthetic of it. And I have to say, I just love it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I wonder if are you finding sort of extra comfort in vintage things these days? I know I am, but I don't want to influence your answer here too much. But I wonder if that's something you're experiencing at all.
Well, I always have leaned to the vintage for, you know, things that already had innate history to them, that I kind of jump into the historical context of that. If it's like a piece of finished pottery or an old antlered knife or a car or old booze, you know, that has always really appealed to me. I think that I don't know, there's something nurturing about like being surrounded by these historically old things, but I'm not so romantic about it where I'm like, I don't have like old kitchen gear. I have like state-of-the-art kitchen gear, you know, like that's, I think, the American schizophrenic. We're like, we love old things, but man, we need the most updated stereo equipment in hi-fi and da da da. You know?
I'm with you on that.
So I think like, in general, it's funny up here, like up here is a closet full of like vintage Woolrich and L.L. Bean chambray and, you know, chamois shirts, and which I never wear in New York anymore. But up here, I kind of just like get into that kind of wardrobe shift of, my country mouse sensibility.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to go back quickly to the magazine, because I think that dichotomy actually is a nice kind of way to get into it. You know, that there's something about W.M. Brown magazine that is, it has that kind of like country mouse, city mouse split. Like there's something I feel like the magazine is equally comfortable talking about like fly fishing somewhere that's 4 hours from the closest cell signal. It's equally comfortable writing about, you know, having dinner at, you know, the finest restaurants in Paris, right? Like, and those two things are positioned in a way where they feel of a kind as opposed to opposites. And I wonder, before we get into the summer issue and what you're working on now, kind of how do you strike that balance? How do you connect those things in a way that's sort of authentic and organic for you?
Well, it comes from a very honest place. It is how I best like to navigate my adult life now. You know, I grew up in upstate New York. I grew up with like provincial Italians and, you know, chicken wings and cheap beer. And, there was also this balance of like, you know, my father, who was an illustrator and commercial artist, like he didn't have to wear a suit every day, but on Friday, like he would put a, you know, Harris tweed on, and like we had Italian tailors in town. It was like, there was always this play of contrast and this idea of high low that, listen, when I was in high school, all I wanted to do was like drink imported beer and like be, you know, like the guy who wasn't that guy. And now as I get older, I realize like that part of my life made such an impression on who I became as an adult. And I embrace the high-low. I like it. I mean, what is better than like a hot dog and relish and yellow mustard? You know, like it doesn't have to be foamy food. That's the easiest example, like food and beverage. And then I think, you know, I do live these two lives. Like I'm up here turkey hunting for the last 3 days and then doing a picture in a tuxedo with cocktails in the evening. Like, by the way, my neighbors have no idea how to figure that out about me. Like somebody came up recently who in the morning saw me in like a Carhartt jumpsuit, you know, and then in the evening came up to drop something off and I was in a tuxedo, and they don't say anything. They're just sort of like, and I'm like, hey, you want a beer? And I like give them a beer and I'm drinking like, you know, a glass of champagne or a martini or something. And it's just funny that there's like no judgment. Like there's no judgment. It's just like, all right, that's who that crazy dude is with the boxy house, you know?
The dude with the boxy house who wears his tuxedos for dinner.
Yeah. And they just totally accept it with like without any judgment. I'm sure they talk about me at, you know, when they get home, but.
It's all right. All right, so let's talk summer 2020. What's coming for the magazine? What are you working on? I mean, we are in the process of printing our next magazine right now, and having made a magazine during the very early stages of this pandemic, I can say it's not the easiest thing in the world. So I wonder kind of how you're faring.
Well, a lot of stuff was already kind of organized and in the hopper, and then
cool.
But there was like, we were earmarking a cover and interior story that was really reliant on us being in Italy. And that issue was going to be launched at PT in June. Mm-hmm. And obviously that got duped. So we kind of had to pivot and create and figure out something new. And for me, that's always really exciting. Like, okay, we're duped here. How do we figure this out? And I think I figured it out. It's nothing is, you know, I think I figured out a kind of domestic version of what we wanted to do. You know, I'm really lucky, Stephen, because like I first and foremost was trained as a photographer. So,
yeah.
And Yolanda is a creative director. So we have this kind of ideal situation where I have an on-set art director 24 hours a day, and I know I brought all my cameras up here, all the Leicas are up here, all the Canons are up here. And I know that if we need to get something done, we'll style it and shoot it. And that, yeah, I have to say, has been the biggest advantage of how, again, the pivot, like how did we get it done? And the light's beautiful up here. We're lucky. We have this house and we have a barn just like filled with props and stuff. So if Yolanda needs to do a still life that has to look like Greece, you know, I could pull out an old blue door and, you know, it's like, you know, that that is, we've been very lucky about that. And then, you know, these machines allow us to have these dialogues with our art directors and create Dropbox. And, you know, we're a lean team to begin with, so we've had to think and work on the fly.
Is there a story that you're most excited about that you like were somehow able to pull together despite all of this?
You know, there's a very, you know, I was visiting a friend of mine in El Salvador, and we had this kind of amazing dream to import like vintage Land Rovers from El Salvador to New York. And sitting on his coffee table was a very obscure, like 4x4 Land Rover centric magazine. And as I looked through it, I was like, holy cow, what is this? And it was basically a journey through the Congo in a Land Rover.
Whoa.
That these three young Brits, two guys and a girl, decided to traverse the entire country in this Land Rover. The imagery was so beautiful and so magical, even though the magazine was just crap print and everything. And it took me a while, but I found the photographer, and I found you know, the group that went on this journey. And I said to them, listen, like, for what it's worth, I really want to excerpt this story. I think it's an awesome road trip. You know, we were in from, you know, Zurich to Norway last month. And I think like this thing is so exciting to see. I was really excited about that. And guess what? I didn't have to jump on a plane and go to the Congo. You know, there is this disintegration of print. And then I think you guys are doing such a great job elevating it. And I would say Alloy and Grit does a great job of that. And I think, you know, Yolanda and I have this advantage of, we have this pool of really incredibly talented photographers that are sitting on archives of stuff that no one ever saw. And mm-hmm. because it was assigned for a print publication that it never happened, or two pages ran, and there's all this stuff. So we've been scrambling like that, saying like, hey, Dewey Nix, like, what's in your archive of cars? Or what's in your archive of like a trip you did to the Mauritius? And everyone's like, yeah, of course I want it. I've always wanted to see this live. So why not have it live this way? And that's been helpful, because then we don't have to worry about so much getting and traveling to a destination to do stuff.
Thinking about you as a photographer, I another project comes to mind, and I'm sure you're limited in what you can say about it, but I know a proof arrived the other day of your next book.
Yes.
A Man in His Car. So the follow-up to A Man in His Watch.
That's right. I always knew in the back of my mind that if I was privileged enough to do a second edition of A Man and His, it was naturally the car story, because there's this same emotional yeah. connection. And for me, it started in the same personal way with my father. And so that was a very natural transition in terms of what the subject was. My publisher loved the idea. So for about a year and a half, I've been tracking down these car stories and shooting these cars. I'm shooting this entire book because I knew that we didn't have the budget to travel everywhere. I know I could kill two birds with one stone. I figured out this idea on how to shoot it so it looked like the watch book, you know, all on black and unadult. So there was this relationship and pairing visually as well as in terms of content. And I mean, teaser, Ben Clymer revisited in the book with two magical
Perfect.
Cars. You know, there's definitely some carryovers. And I think the carryovers are interesting, because then you see this direct relationship to this little machine versus this big machine, and how these two things yeah. are absolutely integrated for most people. I very rarely meet a car guy who's not a watch guy and a watch guy who's not a car guy. And if they're... The yeah. only guy that I know who's not a car guy is Wei Ko. And I'm like, how the hell are you not a car guy? But, you know, he's a motorcycle guy. So same thing.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So that has been an incredible journey. And it's going to be formatted the same way. The materials of the book exterior change a little bit. But it is exactly sort of the approach to the watch book, which was, it wasn't about money. It was not about the price of something. It was about the emotional weight that was put on this thing. And like, yeah, that could be like Adam Chronotis, you know, Casio F7, you know, $12 watch, to, you know, a priceless Cartier from the archives. And so I approached the car book the same way, and I am really excited. We've actually had to edit stuff out. There was so much at one point, and I know,
wow,
and I want to apologize to the car community out there. I know I missed 1,000 stories. I know I did, but we're limited to how much we could fill. So
those are just sequel opportunities, man. That's all that is.
And it'll be out fall. It'll be out this fall, October.
That's great. Wow. That's amazing. I wonder what, you know, in doing this after doing A Man and His Watch, were there moments while you were producing this where you had like epiphanies, or you felt like you gained some insight into what the sort of connection between cars and watches might be?
Well, I think first and foremost that both of these projects came from my own personal interest in it. So, you know, I was meeting all these great watch guys and these that had incredible timepieces, and that was still a bit of a learning curve for me at that point. And with cars, you know, I definitely had more of a knowledge of what was out there. And I think the biggest difference and the most interesting thing that happened is, like, you know, when I talk to guys about watches, I could look back at my interviews, and most interviews average around 20, 25 minutes. And the first few moments are the guys trying to find that story. I'm trying to like pull that story out, right? Car guys, they've been thinking about that story for decades. Like, they come out of the box with, oh, I bought this car because of this, and this reminded me of this, and my first kiss was here, and did it, you know, like, they have been thinking about that car and the story of the acquisition of that car forever, since they owned it. And, you know, that didn't happen as organically with watch guys, but the parallel is, it's the same dialogue in terms of the emotional connectivity. It's just like a big car or this watch that maybe it took me a while to appreciate it. Maybe it was my uncle's and it sat in there, and all of a sudden I look at it and it's like, oh, that's my uncle's watch. That was, you know, like the car guys, man, they just come out of the gate with every detail of why they love this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, that kind of building of stories over time and the sort of the ability to look back and find the value in something and kind of bring it into today is a through line that I see with almost everything you do, which is why I want to make sure we talk about a project that it's, you know, it's not new, but it's something you've done since we last had you on the show, which was a little over a year ago, which was your project with Serica, with the WWW watch.
Yeah.
That you helped design and that you were a part of. And the thing that's interesting to me there is it's looking back, but it's a modern product. Like, it's a modern set of watches. You know, and I can probably count on one hand the number of times I've seen you wear a modern watch. So I'm curious, like, how this project came about and how you see this fitting into kind of the bigger picture of what you're about and what you do.
Well, I have always loved military watches. And I was like an early, like when I was in high school and college, like I loved collecting military stuff. And when I was a kid, I loved G.I. Joes. My dad was in the army. It just was a part of what I liked. And what I liked about military stuff was like its utility and its function and its craft and its, you know, just being well-made and thoughtful with purpose. So I was, when I first started collecting watches, I was going to these military trade shows and weird upstate New York, like sportsman shows. And there'd always be some guy with a pile of like Vietnam or World War II or even World War I military watches. And they were cheap. You know, they were like 50 bucks a piece, 100 bucks for these gorgeous Hamiltons or some amazing Ben Russi thing. And I was just like buying them like crazy. And I loved the case size and I loved how readable they were. Well, fast forward, I can't afford to wear these. I mean, these watches are too expensive now. So the way I was using these watches was, you know, I wasn't wearing my dad's Rolex if I was going to go fly fishing in Costa Rica. I wanted something a little bit more modest and not have to worry about, but I didn't want to sacrifice style. So I would wear one of those vintage watches. And then, of course, I'd get salt water in it and then it'd be ruined and whatever. So when the guys at Serica said, you know, what's out there or what don't you own that you would like to own? I said, well, first of all, I think there should be more watches under $1,000 out there that are great quality, that are somewhere in between like a G-Shock and, you know, a Hoyer. And I said, I really love military style, mil-spec style watches. I like how clear they are. I like the way they look. I think they're really great looking. So let's try to figure that out. So they did. Like, it's very important to me that it was, you know, a Swiss movement and Swiss case design and beautifully put together, and the case size wasn't too big and it was reminiscent of military but nodded to the modern. And, you know, we obsessed about the font on the six for months. For months. And I loved the attention to detail that these guys brought to this in terms of the importance of it. And I think we produced a really beautiful watch that functions great and looks good. And you could wear it from, you know, the field to the cocktail party without missing a hitch. I think, you know, and I think at $600, just about 500 and change euro, it's a hell of a lot of watch for me.
Yeah. 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 I totally agree. I think it's a cool take on a vintage idea, but done in a sort of contemporary way. Like, it doesn't feel like it's a fake vintage watch, which I think is a sort of unique proposition for it. And it, like you said, it's a kind of wear anywhere sort of watch, which I also find appealing. I think there's something nice about the idea of, you know, for people who aren't going to buy 10 watches, you know, having something that they can wear day in and day out.
Yeah. And what's cool about this watch is that these guys have been offering several band styles with it. So it, you know, now they manufactured a stainless steel band for it. So it begins to evolve into maybe several different styles of watches. You know, it could be very military on a NATO. Yeah. It kind of feels divery on a like Swiss, you know, rubber. I actually don't remember what you call those bands, but, you know, those kind of black rubber bands to now the stainless band. And I think it's such a great opportunity to like look at the past and kind of create the modern version of that, so that you don't have to worry about ruining some old vintage watch. You know?
Yeah, totally. You know, I know we're going to have to wrap up in a minute, but there's two kind of last questions I want to make sure we get in here, and they're pretty short questions. So the first one is, I'm sure you were watching with all of the new releases that have come out over the last, you know, 2-3 weeks. And I wonder, is there anything that's really caught your eye? Any watches that you're excited to kind of see in the metal sooner rather than later?
You know, you mentioned that I don't own many modern watches. And part of the reason of that is like the ones I like are just so terrifically expensive now. And I have.
Yeah.
Daughter ready to go to college, so I have to be very conservative about that stuff. But, you know, but one modern watch that I do own that looks and has always looked the same, so it looked like an old watch, is the Cartier Tank. And yeah. I love that watch. And when I saw what Cartier was doing in terms of that, the new perspective on, you know, this current line, I was like, man, I really need to see those in person and put them on wrist. You know, I just think Cartier always, for me, is nodding to their past. Like, they don't forget about the DNA of their past. And, you know, it's not necessarily a recreation per se, but an evolution of what the design is. And yeah. I really like that. And I am always tempted to buy new Cartier stuff, but I, luckily, I'm quite satisfied with my tank, and you know, you gotta put the brakes on for some things, you know.
I know that feeling very, very well. All right, the last thing I'll ask you, and then I'll let you go, is when this all blows over and when travel is allowed again and we can, you know, hightail it to the airport, where's the first place you're going? Where's that plane touching down?
That plane touches down somewhere in Italy. And, you know, soon as the wheels of the plane hit the tarmac when I'm in Italy, I just become the happiest version of myself. I just am like so excited. I actually say, and you may have heard this before, that, you know, the only thing wrong with the house in France is that it's not in Italy. I definitely feel that's my first travel destination is there. And then the other thing is, I just want to give everyone a big, giant, sloppy beer, a bear hug, you know, like, what are we doing? Like, I mean, this whole idea of distance is not, I think, who we are. Unless you're Scandinavian, yeah. You know what I'm saying? but I just think that we are going to do everything we can to get to Europe this summer. I have this friend of mine who is a Swiss air pilot. And he said, you know, I'm flying two flights a week to Newark with commercial planes that we're using as cargo planes. And I could probably smuggle you on board. And I was like, we are going to do that.
All right. Let me know when that happens.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll be able to be allowed in the country, but man, I'm going to definitely be on a plane heading there. So
that's amazing. Business class will be empty. It'll be a good situation.
You got all
the space you need.
I know, my fantasy.
Awesome. Well, thanks for doing this, man. I really appreciate it. It's good to, see you, if not in person, virtually. I'm going to go make myself one of those Negronis, and hopefully we can share one in person soon enough.
Always a pleasure, Stephen. Thank you. And I can't wait to see you in person. Yeah.
Same. Thanks, my friend. Take care.
Ciao. See you.
And to finish up the show, we've got our own Cole Pennington talking about what he's learned about watches while working from home.
We're not only disconnected physically from the groups of people we used to surround ourselves with, we've also disconnected from a routine. Part of my old routine was meeting up with fellow watch folks on a weekly basis and just chewing the fat, you know, seeing who brought what, checking out the new pickups, and generally just enjoying having a bunch of watches out on the table. Now those meetings are digital, and it just isn't the same. But hell, you work with what you got, I get it. But I've actually noticed something interesting happening to my own relationship with watches. A subtle change in the way I look at my collection. For the past year and a half, I've been writing about watches full-time. That means a lot of other people's watches on my wrist, mostly press samples. My watch-wearing habits have been shaped by the product launch calendars of brands. It's an occupational hazard that I'm beyond grateful for, and I've never been closer to the core of modern horology. But here's the thing, I've also never been further away from my own watches, and I didn't even realize it before quarantine. At Hodinkee, we've still worked out a way to get product and continue to produce content to serve the readership, but I've actually been spending a lot more time with my own watches on the wrist. The same watches that were with me long before I started wearing other people's watches, and I've fallen in love with them all over again. With all this time, I look at old travel photos and I see my Seamaster on the wrist. Then I go over to the watch roll, pull it out, strap it on, and find a new reason to just be enamored by it. Then later in the day, I'll switch it up and put on my BB58, which represents modern achievements in my life. Wearing watches like this is sort of an easy way to time travel and hop around this continuum of important moments in your mind. If I'm feeling a little snazzy, I'll throw on the Grand Seiko SBGK 007 and mix it up a bit. I've even been wearing this vintage Jinling watch that I picked up on a trip with my dad to Shanghai to visit Expo 2010 a decade ago. What it comes down to is that I'm really just enjoying the hell out of wearing my watches and I suspect a lot of folks are doing the same with their collections, just wearing multiple watches throughout the day. There can be a lot of hype and showboating in this game, but what I think might happen is that folks might find enjoyment when they wear a watch just for themselves. That's what quarantine might do, because after all, who are we trying to impress here? For me, I rediscovered the joy and simple fun that my own watches can be. I never forget about them, but they have certainly seen a decline in wrist time, and it really felt great to change that. It's funny, because the watches I'm wearing now certainly have me feeling nostalgic. But I'm sure in the distant future, when coronavirus is totally a thing of the past, I'll look back at the same watches I'm wearing right now and think, hey, that was one of the watches I wore through a global pandemic, and it brought me joy. God, I love that thing.
This week's episode was recorded remotely by our group of editors and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.